You know, studies show that 75% of us are walking around every day chronically dehydrated. We're suffering needlessly from frequent headaches, energy slumps, and poor focus.
And many of us tried to solve this problem by drinking coffee, but now there's something different.
We're going to talk to you about Hydrant. They have a solution. Rapid Hydration Mix has four essential electrolytes that your body needs: sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc.
And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by Oxford scientists to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. And there's no synthetic colors or artificial sweeteners. And it's even vegan.
Hydrant starts at just a buck a packet for a 30-day supply. You can save more when you subscribe to the subscription.
And for 25% off your first order, go to Hydrant, And for 25% off your first order, go to drinkhydrant.com and enter the promo code TRN at checkout.
Where do you go, Don?
You go to drinkhydrant.com, enter promo code. Dang, how bad can we be here? What did you say? And what is it, Don? That's drinkhydrant.com and enter promo code TRN for 25% off your first order.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to drinkhydrant.com and enter the code TRN to get 25% off my first order.
Nativedeodorant.com, promo code TRN, 20% off your first purchase.
I have tried many different antiperspirants and deodorants, and usually I just find whatever's the cheapest in the big box store, and I buy like 40 packs, right?
How's that working out for you, Scott?
You know, I've fallen in love with Native deodorant because I really never thought, what's in my deodorant? All I cared was about, is it going to keep me from sweating and stinking? But Native deodorant is different. It has different good stuff in it. None of the bad stuff.
Ingredients like you've heard of, like coconut oil and shea butter. You wear deodorant every day. Shouldn't you be able to understand the ingredient list?
With over 10 scents, including their classics and rotating seasonal fragrances, there's one that you will fall in love with too.
Hey, my favorite one is eucalyptus mint. I just love the way that it smells and goes on. And it really works, Scott.
Hey, you don't believe Don and me? Believe 9,000 five-star reviews. People are happy with Native.
And no risk to try. Free shipping on every order, and Native offers 30-day free returns and exchanges in the U.S.
Get yours now. First order is 20% off. If you go to nativedeodorant.com, use the code TRN.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And we have one of our favorite guests, Matt Fitzgerald. He is an author, runner, athlete, all-around good guy. Knows a little bit about nutrition, too.
He knows quite a bit about nutrition. And he writes books, Scott. Books that we like to read.
In fact, he's written, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Matt, 26 books?
Sure, that sounds about right.
That's about one for...
I stopped counting myself at some point. Yeah,
that's one for every year that you're old. You started writing when you were three. We've actually had him on here a number of times. In fact, we had him on just recently in January. We talked about one of his previous books, Life as a Marathon, and we learned about a new book that's coming out in May called Running the Dream, One Summer Living, Training, and Racing with a Team of World-Class Runners Half My Age. And we've been dying to talk about this book. We got a pre-copy with some photos in it, too. But we're excited. Tell us a little bit about this book and how it came about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's every competitive runner's or every serious, well, whatever. If you get to a certain level of seriousness as a runner, you have this fantasy, right? Like, what if I could take it all the way? You know, like, what would it be like to live like a pro? And, you know, I've been running most of my life. And I'm one of those runners who just, you know, I guess I'm above average talent wise, but I was never going to be a pro runner. You know, that was clear enough even in high school, but I love the sport. And so, you know, well on in my journey, I got to a point where I thought, heck, you know, I'm actually in a position to give this a try. You know, I was, this came together in 2017, the summer of 2017. I was 46 at the time, having a little bit of a renaissance as a runner. I'm very injury prone, but I had a couple good years there where I was just feeling like, you know what, it's now or never. I'm not getting any younger. I'm healthy. So I gave it a shot, spent 13 weeks, an entire summer training with the Northern Arizona Elite professional running team in Flagstaff, Arizona.
You know, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about the NAS team.
Yeah. So they were founded by a coach originally from St. Louis named Ben Rosario. He was a professional runner himself briefly, and then after retiring, just picked up stakes, moved to Flagstaff, and tried to put a team together, and eventually got a sponsor in Hoka One One. And you know, he's a great coach, so it didn't take him long to start winning over some of the top. I mean, there's an abundance of really talented runners in Flagstaff, and you know, he worked very, very hard for it and risked a lot, sacrificed a lot, but he was able to put this team together. He's a real big like culture guy. He's big on, he doesn't necessarily try to recruit the absolute, you know, most talented college runners. I mean, you got to be really good, right, to get a shot with him. But he's huge on, you know, team dynamics, and just that he thinks, you know, if you get the right group of people together, the right chemistry, you know, it raises the level, everyone's level. So he's been at it for a few years now. One of the runners, Alphine Tillamook, just won the Olympic Trials marathon on the women's side.
Oh, nice.
Which is like probably their, you know, this is their the first time they've had an Olympian. So a huge coup for them. They're definitely, you know, a team on the rise.
So I have a question. If you're a runner and you aspire to be on this team, what's the process? Do you apply for a position? Do you go out and run with his group and try to get up front so we can recognize your talent? You know, how do you become one of these elite athletes on his team?
Yeah, so you know, it's not like the NFL or the NBA or MLB where there's a draft and you know, you can't just like show up and knock on the door of Gillette Stadium and ask to talk to Bill Belichick. Like with you know, with running, it's definitely more informal. So Ben, you know, actively, you know, he's a student of the sport. He knows who he, you know, he keeps an eye on runners from the high school level to the college level. And then, you know, he will, you know, reach out to individual runners he's interested in, you know, invite them out, you know, to spend a little time with the group, or he might go visit them. And then also, you know, obviously there are a lot more runners who want to be members of that team than can be. So I'm sure he hears from a lot of athletes too, who kind of pitch themselves to him. But you know, there it's like 12. When I was with the team, there were 12 runners, so that's, you know, not a lot of slots. So you know, the turnover isn't tremendous.
So with 12 slots available, how did you find your way into one of those slots? I'm sure you made some friends with that.
not through my credentials, that's for sure. Or not my running credentials, I should say. I knew Ben Rosario a little bit. You know, he writes as well. So he had read a couple of things I had written. I had read, he wrote a really good book for high school runners and coaches that I had read. So we knew each other a bit. And when I came up with this idea, which I should mention was partly inspired by George Plimpton's book, Paper Lion, back in the 60s, George Plimpton, who was just like this gangly writer dude, who was a huge football fan. This could never happen now, right? But in 1964, I think it was, he was able to talk the Detroit Lions into letting him participate as their last string quarterback in a summer training camp. So I read that book and I thought, okay, that's my model. And you know, there are a number of professional running teams out there. I reached out to Ben, A, because I knew him a little bit, and B, also because their team is really all about openness, transparency, connecting with the broader running community. So I thought my chances were pretty good that Ben would sort of get it, like, because there had to be something in it for him. Like, I wasn't going to contribute. I wasn't going to be a real pro. I was going to be a fake pro. I wasn't going to help. I wasn't going to go to the Olympics, but you know, I was right. You know, just it was pretty easy. Just one email did it. It took Plimpton, 2 years to find an NFL team that would take him. It took me one email, which is it's like, yeah, shows you the difference between running and football.
Well, you know, I never thought about it until you just said that. You would think that an elite team like this would hold all of their tricks and all of their strategies very close to their chest. And here they're writing, they're inviting an author to come train with them, knowing, hey, he's probably going to write a book about us and to share all of the keys to our success. So that's kind of interesting that he would be open to that.
Yeah, that is their brand. It's what they're all about. And, you know, I think there is probably an instinct in a lot of coaches and athletes to hold things close to the vest. But then once you make the decision to try another way, then you're either all in or you're not. And they're all in. Like, you know, you can follow their training almost in real time. They post it on online. So like when one of the runners completes a workout, you can go see what they did that day and give it a try yourself if you're so inclined. So that's what they do. And they were as good as their word. You know, it's one thing for Ben to say, yeah, come on out, I'll treat you just like another member of the team. But he actually did that. And it really hit home one time when because they were in the process of negotiating a new contract with Hoka while I was there, the old contract was ending. And Ben allowed me to sit in on, a meeting where the terms of the new contract were presented. And, you know, it was like kind of classified top secret stuff like it. And so, it was great. You know, I really was just, I was the only one there with gray hair. I was the only one there without actually being paid to do what I was doing. But otherwise, I was just one of the gang.
So before you go down there and start training with him, did you have an expectation of how long you'd be down there? Did you have this A race already scheduled, and were you focused on that race? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I wanted it to hinge. Obviously, if you're going to do this and make it, a compelling story to share, there has to be, has to culminate in something, right? A race. Mm-hmm. For me, it was going to be a marathon. Their athletes do a little bit of everything, track, cross country, different road distances, but they have a little bit of a marathon focus. And so that made sense. And Ben told me, well, our marathon segments are 12 weeks, typically. So he wanted me there for 12 weeks. I made it 13 just so I could spend the first week, like getting my bearings. And so that's why we did it that way. And then, I wanted to run, one of the marathons that actual real members of the team were also running. And so one thing I wasn't really expecting, but it just worked out, is the team's agent, Josh Cox, scored me an elite bib to participate in the Chicago Marathon. So I ran that race as a pro.
Wow.
If you look at the footage, from, I think it was NBC, like before the start, you will see me standing right behind like Jordan Hesse and Galen Rupp and, all these real pros, right on the start line there, which was just an incredible experience. It was the real thing.
So here's what I want to know. Tell me about the first 100 yards of the Chicago Marathon standing around those elites. I mean, how do you apologize? Do you pretend like your shoes kind of untied, or what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty funny. The way I describe it in the book was that, for those 13 weeks, I felt like I was dreaming, because I'm a total geek for running, right? So the whole point of this was to live out a fantasy. And that's exactly, not that, there were low points for sure, but I mean, overall, it was just this enchanted experience. And, the energy on that start line, I mean, I am right there. It's talk about a pinch me moment, what am I doing here? And so, this dreamlike sense, we reach maximum intensity and then the gun goes off, we start moving, and instantaneously I realized it's over, because I still had the marathon to run, but all the real pros, men and women just charge away from me, and I get swallowed up by the people I actually belong with, my fellow amateurs. And so that's, I can't remember how many guys were in the men's pro division. So let's just say 30. I finished 30th or last in the men's pro division, even though I ran well. But yeah, I was back with the people I belong with. And
so let's back up a little bit from the start. How are you treated like as an elite? Do you have your own bathrooms and your own pre-meal foods? I mean, tell us that experience up front, because that's different than mid-packing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like on one level, professional running is not the NBA, but it's still a professional sport and it's treated as such, especially, a major world major marathon like Chicago. So, you know, I flew with the other member of NAZ Elite who was running Chicago, Aaron Braun, since retired. And when we landed at O'Hare, you know, we were part of like just a small group of VIPs who had, you know, a limo that would take us to the hotel. Wow. And then the registration is at the penthouse of the host hotel, where it's like they've got all these snacks laid out in this comfy lounge, and there are movies you can watch. And so you have your own like special private registration where you get your number. You know, there were like, I don't know, 40,000 people in Chicago. My number was 33. yeah, you get like, you know, I got a free hoodie, a free backpack. You know, there's a dinner. And then like you get a bus right to the start line, like a, you know, a tent, VIP tent, your own special warm-up area. The single greatest perk of the whole thing were our private porta potties. So I think there were 48 pros in total, and there was there was probably a dozen porta potties. So like there were no lines for these things. Plus when we eventually finished warming up and we're all paraded out to the start area, Galen Rupp, the American runner who ended up winning that day, it was like 2 minutes before the start, and he suddenly dashes back to the VIP tent to get like a last minute tinkle in. And I thought, well, if he can do that, I'm going to do it too. So I just chased him right back to the porta potties, got that last dribble out right before the race. I thought, like, this is cool. Like, it's going to be hard to go back to slumming it as a regular marathoner after this.
That's a real luxury of trail running. There are bio break opportunities up and down that trail. That's not an issue.
No.
As you can see, Matt is reliving this experience. What a great, actually it is running the dream, right? Which is the book. And I like the way that you laid it out. Don and I were just talking about this pre-podcast, that it's almost like a journal where it's sequential in when you show up, and then a kind of a countdown to your Chicago marathon. Tell us a little bit about, you know, a lot of us may have this fantasy to go train with an elite pro team. Tell us a little bit about your expectations of what you thought was going to happen and how those expectations may have been dashed, or what was the most different thing that you expected.
Yeah. So I had run, I think, about 40 marathons when I went out there. So I was 46 years old. My first marathon was at 28. My fastest marathon I had run 9 years before at age 37. So, and I hadn't come within 8 minutes of that time since then. So I was pretty sure that, you know, PRs were behind me. You know what I mean? Like, I was just facing reality. So, but as a coach, I'm a big believer that any passionate recreational runner should model their training on what the pros do. You have to scale it down, but these folks actually know what they're doing, and not enough recreational runners actually pay attention or even know what the pros do. Not just like the runs, but some of the ancillary stuff they do to like keep their bodies together and all that. So I wanted this thing had to succeed for me to prove, you know, as an amateur runner, like, doing what the pros do actually is good for us too. And so I decided my definition of success would be to run my fastest marathon time, since my PR. I didn't think I could approach my best time because I was 46. It was 9 years ago. But the transformation I underwent in Flagstaff was just beyond my wildest expectations. It truly redefined my sense of what was possible. Like, even I lost 9 pounds. Like, you know how skinny I am, right? You know, I showed up in Flagstaff at my racing weight, what I thought was my racing weight, 150 pounds. I'm 6'1". I was already like, how do you get skinnier than that? I raced Chicago at 141. Like, wow. I would blow away in a stiff breeze, but you know, I wasn't unhealthy. I got there the right way, just training hard. I lived with a member of the team, Matt Yano, who just has this immaculate diet. And so I just sort of copied the way he ate, you know, which, you know, even as serious recreational runners, we there's slack that we don't even realize is there in our training and our diet. And I thought, man, I'm already doing everything right. What can really change? Well, I had my eyes opened out there, and it was just a lot of little things, you know, the diet, the training, the overall lifestyle, naps. And they added up, and I just felt 10 years younger by the time after those 13. I didn't even look the same. I had all these veins popping out everywhere. Like it, and it wasn't maybe sustainable, but I felt great. I ran well. And so it was a smashing success on that level, beyond my wildest expectations.
And frankly, that's why you should read the book, is not just to share in the great story that Matt weaves through this whole thing, but there's stuff in here that you can learn as a mid-pack backpack runner that you can maybe integrate into your training.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. You've had a lifetime of running when you went in, and you pretty well figured out, I've done a lot of research. Nobody reads as much as Matt. You know, you're putting things all together. You're a coach.
He's written books.
And you go 26 of them, Scott. And you go in there, what changed? What just was like, you can't do that. You need to do this now. What did you come away with?
Yeah, so, you know, quite honestly, even the nuts and bolts of the marathon training were a little different from what I'd always done. I remember like doing a particular workout, and I asked Ben Rosario, the coach, like, why did I just do that? And he gave me this whole speech like, well, you know, the mistake that so many runners make with marathon training is that they actually just do 10K training and tack on long runs. And I thought, guilty. Like, that's like what he described as a mistake was exactly how I'd always done it. And so like he would do this thing, just to get real specific, like we would do 2 long runs per week versus just one. One was kind of like a more of like a medium long, and one was real long. And typically at least one or two would actually have some faster segments in it. And that's just something I hadn't done before. Like, even though, you know, I work from home, Wednesday is the same as Saturday for me. Like, I have the time, I could have done that, but for whatever reason I didn't. And it was just like, that's the difference between like a good amateur coach like me and a real pro coach like Ben. He's got like a few more tricks up his sleeve. So there was a lot of other stuff just outside the running that I kind of expected to benefit from, you know, like just access to physical therapist. And at any time I was banged up, like the very complex warm-ups they do with all these mobilization exercises, all that was beneficial as well. What was really surprising to me is I did smarter runs. Like the running, like, was, I thought I had that all figured out, but I really benefited from Ben's, you know, slightly different approach.
Did they focus more on mileage for you or time? Because I would imagine the guys around you might have been faster, so you'd be out there for an extended period of time. Was it backed off a little bit for you, the mileage?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the idea was not to just throw me to the wolves, like, and have me try to do exactly. I mean, a lot of these people are running 120, 130 miles per week. You know, I had never run more than 94, I think. And I ended up injured at the end of that 1 week. And I was a much younger man when that happened. So no, like, and in point of fact, like, even the individual members of the team, like, yeah, they can all handle a lot, but they're all unique. And so a smart coach treats them all as individuals. And so Ben was already doing that with the 12 pros, you know, giving them slightly different workouts based on what he knew about them. So he just did the same thing with me. He just had to make bigger modifications for my sake. So I ran a lot by my standards, and definitely I ran slower than everybody else. But yeah, it was scaled down for sure from what the real pros were doing.
I guess I'm just kind of picturing, you know, the team shows up at 6 o'clock, you know, they have their, you know, Dunkin' Donuts and whatever they have in the morning.
I don't think they're eating Dunkin' Donuts.
And so they're all assembled in the parking lot to go out. Or maybe it wasn't like that at all. Maybe you're just on your own schedule, doing your own thing, showing up and just doing the work at your time that's best for you. How did it look?
Yeah. So, you know, to be clear, like about 80% of the running that was done was easy runs, you know, like that's how it's done. So, I mean, there were epic speed workouts and stuff, but most of it is just your average morning Wednesday easy run. And it's funny, when I first got there, I, you know, if I had wanted to, I could have run at least with the women on the team and the easy runs, but it just wouldn't have been smart, especially I was at 7,000 feet, you know, and I live at low altitude in California. So when I first got there, I was just off the back constantly, because I wasn't, it was just, it would have been dumb to do even my easy runs too fast just to have a little company. So Ben, the coach of the team, would often just hang back with me, so I had someone to run with. But it's funny, over as the weeks went by, without, you know, trying harder in my easy runs, suddenly like I'm running with the women in the easy runs, and I'm not overdoing it. Part of that is because their easy runs are really easy, you know, for them. And part of it was that I was getting fitter, and actually by the end, I was actually doing the easy runs with the guys sometimes, and it wasn't a problem. For workouts where, like, you know, everyone's sort of running close to their limit, the way they would orchestrate is that Ben would have me start first. It was kind of like this, it just became this running joke. Like, everyone else is still warming up, and I'm like this sacrificial lamb, just first up to the cone, send me off. Otherwise, the others would be waiting all day for me to finish up. So like, it just became like, there's so many scenes in the book where I'm plugging along, just feeling like, man, I'm having a great day. I am so awesome at this. And then like, you know, two of the guys on the team would just blow by me like I'm a dropped glove or something. It's just like back to reality.
Hey, you mentioned elevation and you're at 7,000 feet there in Flagstaff. You know, and you look at some of the major training areas in the world, Boulder and Fort Collins and up in Oregon, Flagstaff, of course. How important is it? Did you notice that there was a huge advantage of acclimating to 7,000 and then going back down to elevation and running your marathon in Chicago?
Yeah, it's difficult to tease. You know, this is not a controlled experiment, so many things changed for me, that being one of them. We know it went well. You know, they do, one of the things they do, because that's a big adjustment, even if you have elite talent, you know, like a lot of the members of the team, like Matt Yano, the guy I live with, you know, he grew up in Maryland. So when he first came to Flagstaff, you know, even though he had, you know, the genes of an elite runner, it was a huge adjustment for him. And so I was prepared for it. Before I even went out there, I started taking supplemental iron, you know, because the whole point of training at high altitude is to, it stimulates red blood cell production, but in order to be able to produce those red blood cells, you need an adequate iron supply. So I was in good hands, you know, like it's a disaster for a lot of people to go up to altitude. If they don't know what they're doing, they're not prepared, but I was prepared. So I had blood testing done to see if it was actually doing what it was supposed to do, to make sure my iron was keeping up. My first 3 days there, my training was reduced to almost nothing just to, you know, ease me into it. A lot of people without, you know, again, without good coaching, they just dive into training. It's like, yay, I'm in Flagstaff. Let's run 20 miles and they never recover, you know? So everything was set up for me to succeed. What remained to be seen is like whether I was a responder or not, you know, whether, because this altitude just doesn't work terribly well for everyone. But like within a very short period of time, I was running the same times at 7,000 feet that I was at 181 feet or wherever I am here in California. So, so it clearly worked out well for me.
Hey, what about naps? You mentioned naps. Yeah. Is that you work at home? And not to get too personal, but do you take an afternoon nap while you're working at home? And do you find that that's beneficial, or was this something new that you added to your training?
Yeah, so I am not a napper for whatever reason. Like, I only nap if I'm at death's door with the flu. Mm-hmm. And like anytime I do nap, I never recover. Like my day is just over. So I could, you know, lie down at 2 p.m., get up at 3. I might as well just stay in bed. Like my brain, my body, they just never come back. So, you know, when I arrived in Flagstaff, you know, I made it understood, like, I'm here to do everything that you real pros are doing. And I started to get a hard time from some of the members of the team, when they learned that I wasn't napping. I told them that, you know, even though I was trying to do everything like a real pro, the point is, like, I mean, I still had to make my living like writing and coaching and stuff. So I would do all the stuff they were doing and then get back to the house I was staying at and like have to write training plans and books and stuff. So it was hard for me. I'm like, where's the time going to come from for a nap? But eventually when I got just deep, deep, deep into the training, I had no choice in the matter. Like, I just, there was one day I describe it in the book where I fought it in every way I could. Like, I had coffee, I tried to talk myself into staying awake, and like, before I know it, I'm just on the bed drooling. yeah. So you can see why it's a standard practice for the real pros, because it becomes an absolute necessity.
We're talking a lot about running, but what about some of the other ancillary type of activity? Was there cross training and, you know, different things that you made, gait analysis? I mean, what other things besides just, you know, going down the road fast?
Yeah. So there was one coached team strength workout per week. There's a facility there that's sort of provides those types of services, like chiropractic, physical therapy, testing, strength training for the team. It's called Hypo 2 Sport. And so we would go there every Thursday and do like a pretty brutal coached 1 hour team strength workout. And then it was understood that you were supposed to do another one like on your own, which I would do in Matt Yano's garage on Mondays. So 2 days of, you know, two formal strength workouts per week. And then pretty much everyone on the team did what's kind of known as corrective exercise. And those are just mostly when you get banged up or you suffer an injury, you go to a physical therapist and they say, here, do this stretch, do this little strengthening exercise. It'll keep you from getting the same injury again. And then you kind of collect these over time and it becomes a routine. And almost everyone did these daily. And I was constantly on the verge of falling apart when I was there. I was in with the physical therapist constantly, like, my groin hurts, my knee hurts, my Achilles hurts. And so by the time I left, I actually timed it one day because it doesn't feel like a workout. You can do it in your pajamas, you know, but like I added up, it took me 35 minutes to get through this thing. You know, I was doing it every day on top of two runs and all the other stuff. It becomes kind of a full-time deal. Most of the runners on the team only like do standard cross training, like the elliptical machine or whatever, when they can't run. But I did a little bit of that stuff on an ongoing basis just so I could get my volume up without destroying myself. So I did do like more cross training than the real pros did, but less total training.
You mentioned that you had to hold your day job down. Did the rest of the team have day jobs, or were they 100% professional runners?
None of them had any sort of, none of them were baristas, put it that way. Some of them do coaching. There was a married couple on the team, Ben and Steph Bruce, who they lead running camps. So like every summer. So actually in the middle of my time there, they had just took, I think it was 4 days to host a running camp. And so it's a little side business for them. Matt Yano, the guy I stayed with, he did some coaching on the side. Some of the young, the fresh out of college members of the team, you know, like I said, I sat in on the contract meeting with Hoka. So I knew what these folks make. And there's a spectrum, you know, the ones who'd been at it and had a lot of success. I mean, Matt Yano's house was better than my house. His car was better than my car. But then some of the, the folks 23, 24, fresh out of college were, they had roommates and living kind of hand to mouth. So a lot of them did need some kind of little supplemental income, but nothing onerous like working at a shoe store, selling running shoes 6 or 8 hours a day.
Well, I don't know what kind of car Matt had, but you have a pretty nice car. You have a nice Tesla. So I've seen that car. So I don't know what he's driving, a Bentley or
Lamborghini.
Something.
Lamborghini.
Yeah.
But I didn't bring the Tesla. First of all, the Tesla is my wife's.
Oh, okay.
second, I didn't bring that car to Flagstaff for two reasons. First, I knew it would have gotten really, really dirty. It's like we were constantly on trails there. And two, like I was already going to stick out like a sore thumb. Like I'm trying to fit in.
Right.
And like, if I roll up all pimping in this, you know, six figure electric car, like that would not have been the best way to just be one of the gang.
So what did you rent a truck? What made you fit in?
I brought the Funmobile, as it is nicknamed. It's a Mazda crossover. That's my car. It was perfect. I mean, the thing smelled like a locker room and, you know, looked like a tank that had been through battle by the time I left. But it was the right car for the circumstances.
Hey, you bring up locker room. Let's talk about that. Tell me about the gear that fell into your lap as you walk in there, because we're all gear junkies, I think. And we can, if you imagine being a professional runner, part of that fantasy comes the shoes that you get to open up in the boxes. What did your what's that called? Your swag bag look like?
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, I was sort of a Hoka wearer before I got there, but I talked to Ben Rosario before I went out, you know, cause I wasn't sponsored the way they are. And I wasn't looking for, I mean, already I'm getting the free coaching and running Chicago Marathon as an elite. I wasn't going to ask for too much or expect too much. And I asked Ben Rosario before I went there, like, am I going to like look like a douchebag if I show up in Nikes? You know, it's like,
let me answer that for you, Matt. Yeah. Yes, you will.
And that's what he said. No.
Good.
But no, he understood, that like I was doing the real pro thing, but in fact, like I would show up. They all had these like nice team issue warm up suits, and I would show up to every run wearing cargo shorts, like these ratty old cargo shorts. And they became another running joke. Like I would strip off the cargo shorts and have my regular running shorts underneath. But I did get swagged out. I mean, I definitely got my share of Hoka shoes. And I got, they had other sponsors, like Rural Recovery was another one. So I got like it looks like inline skate wheels that you like knead your muscles with a little contraption. Yeah. They hooked me up with my first day with the team, I show up and everyone pulls these mats out of the back of their vehicles and starts doing these fancy looking, muscle activation exercises. And I'm just standing there looking like an idiot because I don't have one. And they got like straps to use. So I got all that stuff too. You might be familiar with Martin, the sports drink and the gels now too. That stuff was brand new and not commercially available in the States then, but the team was testing that stuff. So I got hooked up with Martin. And one of the cool things about racing a marathon like Chicago as a pro is that you get your own bottles. Talk about a perk. Like you're not like trying to aim 4 ounces of Gatorade out of a Dixie cup into your mouth while running 10 miles an hour. Like you've got your own special bottle, whatever you want to put in it. So I had Martin in mine.
And that's tasty stuff. I've had that. It's very smooth and has a good taste to it.
Yeah, it worked out extremely well for me. It was like another one of those things that made it almost impossible to go back to being an amateur. It's like Dixie cups again. Come on, man.
Hey, I want to know what it feels like to be able to grab the bottle with your name on it and somebody's there carefully trying to hand it to you, probably nervous, probably thinking, this, I can't fail at this. These guys and gals need their bottle. So they hand it off to you, you drink it. How did it feel just to toss the bottle off to the side? Like, there you go, tossing that bottle.
Well, funny you ask, because one of my concerns, as you can imagine, I was picking the brains of the real pros throughout the entire process because I was doing so much was new to me, and the bottles thing was huge. Like everyone, like there's like this whole art and science and perhaps overthinking into like choosing the perfect bottle. And a big issue is, if you have 48 pros and they don't hand them to you, by the way, they sit out on tables.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So like you try to choose something that's a functional, but also like distinct. So no one will mix it up with their own bottles. And apparently like this is the scuttlebutt, like a lot of the East African runners just pick the first bottle they come to. They don't really care. At least that was like, that might be changing, but So I had all these, because I knew I was going to be just about the last person to come to these tables. And I thought, okay, odds are pretty high that, you know, someone just
here's the last bottle standing.
Yeah, and that actually happened.
They took the table down and just left your bottle on the ground.
That happened too.
Oh, sorry.
Because eventually when I got like, you know, 10, 12 miles in the race, like into the race, I'm so, not only am I behind all the real pros, I'm so far behind all the real pros that the race staff don't think any more are coming. You know, I had this, the pros had, you know, the elites had red bibs, like they, you can't miss them. And I got to the first table, my bottle was there. And by the way, it did feel great to just toss the bottle. It did feel great. And I thought that's what it was going to be like the whole way through. But I get to the next table, bottle's gone. I get to the next table, not only is my bottle gone, but the race staff who were operating that station were folding up the tables and taking them away. So it's like, tough luck, old timer.
I still have a question on the bottles. I'm not done with that one yet. So now you're running and you're not up with the elites at this point. I mean, I don't think we're doing a spoiler alert for the book. And you're running, and so you have to toss your bottle, but you're with the normal people now. And there are people on the sidelines as well, kind of watching this stuff go down. And you're like, you're throwing your bottle, and they're probably thinking, hey, dude, you're not supposed to throw your bottle. You're not one of those guys up front, and you're apologizing to him. It's like, no. See, I'm paper lion,
red bib.
Yeah, you know. So to clarify, you're probably imagining like thousands of people around me. I mean, I finished 141st out of 40,000 runners. So, yeah.
Oh, well done.
By the time I get deep into the race, it's actually pretty spread out. Like, the last few miles, I'm alone. Like, I'm absolutely alone. So it didn't look that bad for me to be tossing my bottles aside. Like, you know, I was, I was behind the real pros, but ahead of most of,
normal people. I apologize, Matt. I was really kind of thinking that you were Scott Nyspeed. So, you know, I imagine hitting somebody in the side of the head with a bottle, you know, something like that. Cause that's where we hang out.
No, I did. I did surprise myself. I actually, you know, and it was a, I did not just get completely engulfed by this tidal wave of mid pack runners. And, I ran well. I was pretty far up there.
Can we say how well you did? Is that a spoiler for the book?
No, 144.
You know, 141st.
I was blogging about this thing while people can look it up for themselves. Whatever.
Well, I mean, from a personal standpoint of a time.
Yeah. So, you know, my PR going into this whole experience was 2:41:29. Like I said, that happened like 2008 or 2009, and I was 37. And the fastest I had run since 2:41:29 was 2:49 something. So 8 minutes slower. So my definition of success was just doing better than that. But in Chicago, I ended up running 2:39:30. Wow. So a 2 minute improvement on, and again, I'd run 40 marathons. It wasn't like this was my third bite at the apple. Like, you know, I'd been slowing down for years and somehow just got 2 minutes faster in my 41st marathon at age 46, 9 years after I thought I had run my fastest marathon.
Matt, you've been doing this for a while. Have you ever, prior to this, have you ever been coached? Have you ever hired a coach yourself?
I did one time, actually. So I grew up in New Hampshire and, you know, ran competitively in high school. And there's this guy named Kevin Beck who went on to a kind of a similar career. Like I stopped running for a while and got back into it. He kept right on running, became a coach, writes about running. And so we went to different schools. But we sort of reconnected when I'm like, hey, I know that guy, you know, from back in New Hampshire. I would see he wrote a book. I saw his byline in places. And at one point when I was getting to the point where I thought like, I felt the clock ticking, you know, as a runner, I hired him actually to coach me. But it was different because it was remote. So it's the same way I coach other runners. So very different experience.
Is there one thing that you took away from the experience from a training standpoint that you now have in your regular training that you didn't prior?
Well, I still train for marathons the Ben Rosario way versus the old Matt Fitzgerald way, which was apparently 10K training with long runs tacked on. So yeah, I mean, and also like a lot of the workouts, you know, one of the cool things about having a coach is like they do the thinking part for you. You still have to do the hard work, but they do the thinking. And so, you know, Ben would put all this creativity into giving all these different workout designs. And, you know, I have an online record of all the stuff I did. So I can just go back to that and pull them out. So yeah, you know, I definitely took that home with me. I still do like the whole corrective exercise routine. I've tightened it up a little bit. It's now 20 minutes versus 35, but I just saw the value in that. The drills, you know, anytime they did like a faster workout, they would include in their warm up like a sequence of drills. Nothing fancy, the kind of stuff that's out there, like, you know, high knees and butt kicks and A skips and B skips. Like, that was the kind of thing I'm like, I don't have time for that. Well, now I do have time for it because I just saw the value. It's like, you know what? It really doesn't take that much time. So, you know, I couldn't take Ben back to California with me. I couldn't take 7,000 feet. I couldn't take the trails. I couldn't take my teammates. There's a lot I had to give up. But the stuff I could take, I did. And yeah, it makes a difference.
That's interesting to me. So preparing for a road run, you still have some trail work, some off-road work in there. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, we did all of our easy runs on trails, all of them. It's just, I mean, it's more pleasant. I mean, that's why trail runners are trail runners in the first place, mostly, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, even people who compete on the road think it's just nicer to be on a trail. So there's that. And it's also a more forgiving surface. I mean, the thing I found when I got up to, you know, 80, 85, 90 miles a week of running, you know, before when I got to that level, like, even when I was younger, like getting out of bed in the morning became a real issue, you know, just like the gears were grinding. But I felt pretty good like all the way through. I just didn't feel beat up. And I have to think the trails were a big part of that. So we were only on the roads for, you know, workouts or like, you know, marathon pace type of stuff.
So if someone's reading the, thinking about getting this book, can they expect to be in your gym bag there to kind of really see what you went through and incorporate some of your lessons into their own training?
Yeah, it's, you know, the analogy I like to make is, you know, there's some parents who have kids who don't like vegetables, so they might like sneak some spinach into a cheesy casserole to get them to eat the spinach. And so this book is, it's a story, you know, it's narrative. You know, you are vicariously living kind of every runner's fantasy through me, but you know, every runner cares about their own running more than anyone else's. And so there's a lot of practical stuff. And you said it yourself, infused in the narrative. So it's not, there aren't like, you know, call outs, but you know, some workouts I describe in complete detail, like, you know, enough detail where you could, if you're so inclined, do it yourself. The strength exercises, yeah, a lot of it. A lot of the, you know, the diet on the diet side. So yeah, even if like you just don't really care about the vicarious experience at all, like if you just want what's in it for you, there's plenty of that in there.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that again. The book is Running the Dream: One Summer Living, Training, and Racing. With a team of world-class runners half my age. It's coming out in May. You can pre-order it now at mattfitzgerald.org, or you can, you know, Amazon, wherever you get your books, you can pre-order it now.
And we've done a number of podcasts, as mentioned in the beginning, with episodes with Matt, you know, Diet Cult and How Bad Do You Want It, that book. I mean, there's so many good books that you have written out there that target to our passion.
So. Yes, this is probably not my last. Either. In fact, I know it's not my last. I'm well, working on more books.
And actually, I know that you have one coming out again in November called The Comeback Quotient. Can you give us a teaser on that?
Yes, apparently. So, yeah, I told you November. I think it's going to be early next year.
Okay.
Now, publisher always gets to decide these things. And sometimes I'm the last to know. So, yeah, The Comeback Quotient is sort of a sequel to How Bad You Want It. It's endurance sports psychology. And the focus of this one is, you know, we all love a good comeback story in sports. You know, people who suffer a devastating injury or a major illness, or they retire and they come back. And, you know, not everyone can pull off a great comeback. Like, there's just a certain special something that it takes talent. The way I like to say it is, it takes talent to do hard things. It takes mental fitness to deal with hard things. Mm. And the great ones have both. So like, what is that special something that people have who are able to make the very best of the very worst situations? And we all get there as endurance athletes, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're always kind of coming back from something or trying to overcome something. This is what we sign up for. So it's a book that just sort of investigates, like, is there something that's common in the psychology of these athletes who are able to pull off stunning comebacks? And, like, you know, can we bottle it and take some home for ourselves? Fortunately, the answer is yes.
With 26 books, how do you come up with ideas? Does the publisher say, hey, Matt, we want something along these lines? Or does it just come to you on a long run where you just, I've been thinking about this for a while. I'm gonna write on this.
Yeah, I'm a very, I guess, curious person. And I guess I'm passionate about the things I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that makes me an idea factory. Like, yeah, I'm always working on something, but I've always got a list of like five other things I can't wait to get to as well. Like, it's probably going to slow down at some point, but it hasn't yet. There's expect to hear more from me. I hope Matt Fitzgerald fatigue doesn't set in. I worry about that sometimes. Like, enough already, dude.
No, I think that your topics move around enough, right, to keep it fresh. So it's not the same story retold.
Yeah, like, you know, my idea of hell is actually writing the same book twice. Mm. That's the nature of creativity. It's like, okay, I did that. Now what? And yeah, so
well, that's what's fun about running the dream is there's good stuff in there that a runner can get to how they can become a better runner themselves. But it's written in kind of a novel type, you know, where you're talking about relationships and characters and your experience. So it's actually a very good read.
I want to know about Audible books. Can you listen to these, download them? Are you a narrative reader?
Yeah. So when Life is a Marathon came out, which we've discussed previously, they found this actor to read that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the only book of my own that I've actually read was How Bad You Want It. And it just about broke me. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. And so I'm not eager to do that again. It's way harder than you would think.
What's hard about it?
It's, you know, I thought, well, shoot, like, I'm good at reading and it's just reading. And not only that, I wrote the words.
Right.
Like, how hard could it be? But I was thinking, like, you know, when you read like a bedtime story to a child, all you have to do is read competently. If you're reading something that people are actually going to purchase and invest hours of their life into listening to, it has to be perfect, not just competent. And there's a huge difference. And that's what I didn't understand. Like when you just read a bedtime story, there are all these, you're not even aware of them, but there's like these awkward pauses and bumbles and, you know, backing up a step. And so I get into the studio and I start reading my book. I'm doing a little bit of that. And the sound engineer is like,
Cut.
Do it again. Like, it was like four-hour days plus some cleanup afterwards. And by the end of these sessions, like, my abs hurt because I was so tense. Like, it was like physically exhausting, not just mentally. So anywho, all this to say that they found this actor to read Life's a Marathon, who is just stellar. He did such a good job that for this book, I specifically requested him. And I believe they got him for it. So his name is Jamie something or other.
I know when I listen to those books, I just assume that's the voice of the author. I just assume that,
right?
You know, and so, and there was one book that was written by somebody from Britain. And so they found the actor that had a British accent. So that I was fairly well duped into thinking that was the guy. But I'm glad our criteria here on the podcast is not to be that precise.
We're not even competent.
We have a little bit of flexibility.
Not only are we precise, we're not competent. We're just hacks. Hey, we also want to. You had mentioned on a previous recording we had with you about this cool running camp concept. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that's going?
Yes, thank you. Endeavor Run is called. It kind of, in a way, it came out of my Flagstaff fake pro runner experience. The guy, the mastermind behind Endeavor Run is this guy named Jake Tuber, who he was. I started coaching him actually while I was in Flagstaff, or right after I got home, and he was so fascinated by, you know, what I was able to experience. He's like, how can we make an opportunity like this available to other runners? And so this is sort of like a running camp concept that's blown out into more of here's your chance to be a professional runner for, you know, a concentrated period of time. So that's the concept of the camp, is really sort of to distill what I was able to experience into something that anyone who signs up and pulls out their credit card can also experience.
Where is this camp located?
So it'll be in, and again, you know, it's still on for now, this crazy coronavirus thing, but so it's scheduled for July. So I'm hoping we'll be okay. Mm-hmm. It'll be in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay.
So kind of another running Mecca, not 7,000 feet like Flagstaff, but pretty cool spot.
Yeah. It's interesting how running Meccas are created. People kind of conjugate to these particular regions, you know, Bend, Oregon's one of them, Flagstaff's another.
Yeah, some places are just, Flagstaff, it's just like, even if there were no runners there yet and you went there as a runner, you would want to stay,
yeah.
You know, if you could handle the altitude. But then it becomes self-reinforcing, right? So it's not only that they have nice trails and fresh air and whatever, but once there is a critical mass of runners there, then it's self-reinforcing. It draws others in. I hope Flagstaff doesn't get ruined because it's so hot right now. Runners are flocking there. It's like one of those things you always want to be like the last one in and then shut the door behind you.
Maybe we should put some fake news out there about Flagstaff. Isn't really
it's
that
a hotbed of coronavirus. Yeah, stay away. Stay away.
It's not that great there. You know, there's
yes.
So the book is Running the Dream, a summer living, training, and racing with a team of world-class runners half my age. It's coming out in May. It's a great read. Lots of good meat in there, too. And if you want to learn more, you can go to mattfitzgerald.org. All this stuff will be in the show notes.
Do you have any spots left in your coaching that you do? I imagine that you're probably in high demand.
Yeah, so the one-on-one coaching I limit to five athletes, so I have time to write mm-hmm. and train and do all that other stuff. And yeah, I pretty much always have a full roster plus a waiting list. But I also do I have a custom training plan service, which is like kind of a sweet spot between one-on-one coaching and like cookie cutter off the shelf uh-huh. one size fits all training plan. So you just fill out a questionnaire and then I design a plan from scratch, you know, just for you. But then you don't get the ongoing coaching with it. So, but it's more affordable than the one-on-one coaching and way better than, I think, you know, a cookie cutter training plan.
And they can sign up for that at mattfitzgerald.org.
That's right.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Hey, Matt, thank you so much. As always, it's a lot of fun talking to you. Get a chance to see you out there at Way to Cool 50K. So it's nice to physically see you as well as virtually have a fun discussion with you.
All right. Yeah. Always a pleasure, guys. I'll keep, you know, one of the incentives to keep writing books is to have reasons to keep coming back on your show.
I hope there's better reasons.
Yeah. Well, flattery will get you everywhere.
So go out and run,
Maz.